this evening, we want to look at the myth of racism and where all this kind of come from and the foundations. So James is going to give us a brief spin again, and then we're going to move into an exercise and then look at that exercise from the perspective of the dynamics of racism and how that plays into our whole myth understanding about different cultures and different people, and look at that again from the perspective of persons of color. But we'll have a different twist tonight on our workshop. So with that, let's go ahead with our contextual spin.
Good. I want to read a poem to you before I begin. And you may think this does not have anything to do with our subject. And you may be right. But it kind of felt to me like it belonged. So I thought I'd read it to you. It's called The Second Coming by an Irish poet named Yeats, who some of you may know. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. Do you like that? Well, as Nadine said, I want to take, a few minutes to spin a few provocative images for you. And again, given our time constraints and really the intent of our sessions, these will be simply provocative images. There's a lot more to say, a lot more to explore, a lot more work to do. But I want to spin out for you four provocative images that have to do with the myth of racial identity and racial superiority and its application, its use, in our experience. Let me move this chart out of the way. So we can use the board here. You'll remember that in the last session, we suggested that in our history, that the defining relationship, the defining tension has been between the European population in the Americas, and particularly in North America, and the African population. And then that the third term, so to speak, in that tension or in that relationship was the native populations, the native peoples. And we'll talk about, before we finish this evening, some of the things that have taken place in our history that make clear that the defining tension has been here between the Europeans and the Africans. While nonetheless, the relationship of the European population to the native peoples could best be described as genocide. And we'll talk in a few minutes about some of the ways that we've idealized native peoples in this century in our conversation about who they are. Nonetheless, the defining relationship has been here. But one of the interesting things that's happened is that the the encounter between the African population and the native population has in fact birthed a new population that some people in these days are calling La Raza. I mentioned to you a couple of days ago that the Spanish philosopher José Vasconcelos suggests that we are seeing in the Americas a new genetic stock come into being that he calls the cosmic race, La Raza Cosmica. Whether you call it that or not, the confrontation of these three peoples has given birth to a new genetic reality, a new genetically mixed reality. And that's caused all kinds of difficulties for those who would live by the myth of racial superiority and racial uniqueness and racial identity, or the myth of race as it was born in Europe. In many ways, when you think about our nation and most of the nations of the Americas in these days, they're like a genetic cyclotron in that genetic material is whirling around, being exchanged so dramatically that, I mean, things are happening in these continents that I'm sure have never happened before in terms of a short span of time and with such drama. All of the continents, of course, around the world are genetically mixed, and great dramas of conquest and being conquered and so on have taken place. But in the space of 500 years, something very dramatic has taken place in the Americas. And so today, as a consequence, we have almost like a genetic cyclotron with the pool of genetic information swirling around and sweeping up whole populations. You walk through the city streets, for example, of Uptown in Chicago, and you'll see that genetic cyclotron on the streets of Uptown. Just incredible realities are emerging. But now let's talk for a moment about mythology.
Jim?
Yes.
What about Asians? You mentioned Asians.
Yes, that's right. And I will, and we'll work on Asians a little bit later. But that's certainly the case. That one of the things that's happened in recent years as a consequence of the pressure of this new group of people and Asian Americans of all kinds beginning to flood into our continents is that this basic relationship has been relativized so that now new possibilities of coalitions and relationships have begun to emerge. And for us particularly, it's dramatic in the United States, but it's also true in Canada and throughout the Americas, that this fundamental tension is being relativized by a growing Hispanic population, a mixed population, and by the growing population of Asian Americans in our cities particularly. But let's talk about mythology for a few moments. Let me get a little bit of space here. The book that I read to you from is one of Joseph Campbell's last little books. And it's one that I'd recommend to you as something that's very readable and short. It's called The Inner Reaches of Outer Space by Joseph Campbell. And it's a helpful little book to get a hold of the dynamics of mythology and to get inside of what we mean by myth and story and symbol and ritual. And perhaps one helpful way of looking and thinking about mythology we can get a hold of by, let me use something darker here, by a triangle. We'll call this triangle the dynamics of mythology. And in one corner, we'll put story. You could also put myth. This is simply to say that mythology always involves a fundamental story or stories about what it means to be human and about what life's all about. And that mythology also involves ritual or rite. And ritual is dramatic activity through which you tell the story. Many times it's in a highly liturgical setting, like worship. Other times it's activity that we may not recognize as ritualistic activity, and yet its primary thrust is to tell a story about the way life is. And then symbols, objects, icons, and images that are very powerful, that freight or carry the story, and that are manipulated in the rituals, are the key to understanding the sort of the power of mythology. I'm sure there are many ways to talk about mythology, Joseph Campbell suggests, for example, that mythology is the intersection between the outer universe and the inner universe. So that the realm of mythology lies here. And the common coin of mythology is metaphor, not scientifically analytic language, but metaphor is the common coin of mythology, suggests Campbell. And mythology is a way of organizing our deepest insights and intuitions about life and trying to communicate those. So mythology, then, is part and parcel of the experience of being human. And when you say that something is mythological, that doesn't mean it's not true. To the contrary, that's a way of saying that it freights profound truths that are so powerful and deep that we can't communicate them in ordinary, clear, direct language, but we have to use poetic images and metaphors. Now, the mythology of race. The mythology of race, I suspect, grew up in Europe along with nationalism. And you may recall from your history that in the times of the Black Plague, isn't that an interesting metaphor, the Black Plague, that in the times of the Black Death, one of the stories about the Jews was that the Jews were poisoning the wells. And then there were other mythologies about the Jews that began to take hold in medieval Europe. The Jews steal children and use them in sacrificial services where they cannibalize them. All kinds of wild stories. And so that while the fervor of nationalism was beginning to sweep through Europe, there was also a notion being born of racial identity and of race. And probably the Jews were the first other group to be identified as an other race. So that the mythology of race and nationalism sort of grew up together. And in the 1700s and the 1800s, there are a lot of European scholars that spent a lot of effort and energy developing the science of the classification of peoples. That is, they were about the business of articulating the mythology of race. And as that mythology was being articulated by Europeans, well, what it turned out to be was a story about racial superiority. And the mythology of race suggested that you could distinguish different races of people by their physical characteristics, and that physical characteristics expressed inner essences. And you remember that essentialistic language was very important in the experience of European civilization. Well, one of the difficulties for us today in these days is that I suspect that we experience ourselves sort of along a whole spectrum of racial identity. And who we are racially kind of depends upon the needs of the moment and who's naming us. We've noticed, for example, that in many situations we'll go in, like if we're moving into a housing complex, and we'll be categorized as an African-American family or a European-American family, depending upon the quota needs of who's running the housing complex. Same is true of our daughter. And you know, the peculiarities of racial identification in our own history in the United States makes the old essences of European thought sort of difficult to comprehend. But the mythology of race suggested that physical characteristics expressed inner essences. And in a minute, I'm going to share with you a chart that explicates even further the mythology of race. Some names just to share with you. Some of the people that I found helpful and beginning to understand mythology and the way it operates. I've mentioned one already, Joseph Campbell, also a philosopher in the area of religion, whose name was Mercy Eliade, and Rollo May and Paul Tillich, and I'm sure there are many others that perhaps different ones of you have found helpful. One of the characteristics of the myth of race, once it began to be articulated fairly clearly, was a fear of race mixing. Now, we were talking 2 days ago about how in the United States particularly, as the slave trade was picking up momentum, that the first Africans to arrive in what now is the United States touched down in Virginia in 1619. And they, in effect, had the status of indentured servants. And for a period of about 40 years, there was really no racial notion that was the overriding notion of classification, but rather class was more important. And that white and black indentured servants worked side by side. And that many African indentured servants actually worked off their indenture and won their freedom and became free people. And in the midst of that, there was a lot of racial mixing, you know, within the category of class between white and black indentured servants. And there seems to be no notion of whiteness, but rather there was a notion of class. Then in the 1660s, 1662 to 67, Virginia and Maryland led the way in passing laws that began to forbid the mixing of the races. And you may recall that Verlon asked a question about what were some of the forces that were pressing that, and I suggested economics was crucial, tobacco and cotton. Tobacco and cotton were labor intensive and needed lots of ready labor, and the slave trade could provide it. So economics was important, but there was another dimension of the term that was perhaps at least as important, and that had to do with the British Puritan mind, the mentality of those who were populating, particularly New England, but also the Eastern Seaboard. And there was an unholy trinity begin to form in the imagination of the Puritans, and it had to do with sin and sex and race. And during the period of time of indentured servanthood, when there was a lot of race mixing, from the perspective at least of the settlers in Europe, it seemed to be that there was an inordinate number of European, of British and Irish women who were interested in African men. And the first laws against race mixing were motivated at least in part with that in mind and were aimed at white women. Now that was the beginning then of a series of laws and clauses that even later than after the Revolution were adopted as part of state constitutions, many of which were on the books up until the 1960s. I recall the shock I had when, as an eighth grader, we were required to study the Arizona Constitution. And as I was reading the Arizona Constitution, I read a clause which gave me a start when I realized that it meant that my parents' marriage was illegal, because it suggested that anyone... Most of the anti-miscegenation clauses suggested that any race mixing between white and people of any other race was illegal, but they were aimed at African Americans and often were not enforced. But my mother had Native American heritage, and of such an amount that according to the clause in the Arizona Constitution, she and my father shouldn't have been married. That was my introduction to miscegenation. Now, isn't that an interesting term? Miscegenation. What does it suggest to you? What does that term suggest? What's that?
A poor mixture of genes.
A poor mixture of genes, yes indeed. Let me share with you a chart very quickly here. This is from the work of James Davis in his book, Who is Black? Part of the mythology of race suggested some races are physically superior. And as a matter of fact, you can rate races from physically vital to physically weak, depending on the frequency of certain kinds of diseases and so on. Some races are mentally superior to others, and you can rate them from a scale, from most intelligent to least intelligent. And you can imagine, if you lived in the United States or Canada, who was at the bottom of the scale? Native peoples and Africans, the ones who you made slaves of. And then thirdly, race causes culture. That is to say that distinct races have distinct cultures that are genetically transmitted. Fourthly, that race determines temperament and disposition. That is, if you are English, you are naturally staid and self-possessed. And of course, if you're Italian, Well, you know what that means. Or if you're African or Native American. Fifthly, racial mixing lowers biological and intellectual vitality and the capabilities, capacities of a race. That is, if your basic mythology suggests that there are separate races, then you don't take into account genetic drift. As a matter of fact, the races need to remain separate, particularly the ones who are superior, because to mix, to change your racial purity, that's going to affect the vitality of your race. And therefore, the anti-miscegenation laws had that in mind. And you remember we talked about the one-drop rule. The one-drop rule began to be the rule of thumb in the early 1800s and perhaps had the most influence around the 1920s, when it was considered that if you had any traceable African heritage, you were black. Now, interestingly enough, it wasn't thought of the other way around. That is, if you had any traceable European heritage, you were not considered white. But if you had one drop of black blood, you had defiled the race, and so you were black. And that was the rule of thumb, clear up into our time. Now that's miscegenation. Let's think about what this kind of mythology has led to in terms of our relation to both of those peoples, Native peoples and Africans. In terms of Native peoples, have you noticed in this century particularly that the way we have characterized and described Native people is that we have idealized them? I looked in my bathroom the other day and found this empty peanut can that was sold by the YMCA. And I looked at the back of it and I remembered that the YMCA had certification programs for fathers and daughters and for mothers and daughters and for daughters and for mothers and fathers and sons. One of them is called Indian Guides. And one of them was called Indian Princesses. This was for fathers and daughters. One was called Indian Maidens. This was for daughters and mothers. And then one was called Trailblazers. This was for fathers and sons. How many of you were Cub Scouts? Now, do you remember the Cub Scout way? What was the Aquila? Wasn't something? What was that all about?
And Aquila, we'll do our best.
Yes. And do you remember all of the images of Native American integrity and purity that, you know, that helped guide us along the Cub Scout trail? And then, of course, there's the Lone Ranger and his faithful Indian friend. Yes, Kimo Sabe. I mean, even in terms of our understanding of the ecological crisis, we tend to idealize Native Americans. Now, if you're familiar with the social fabric on reservations and reserves in Canada, or if you're familiar with what happens to urban Native Americans, then you are aware of the devastation and desolation, which is the experience of Native Americans in these days, those who have survived the Holocaust. And yet we tend to idealize them. I suspect we idealize them as a little trick on ourselves to help us forget the genocide of the last century. Do you remember our mythology about Native Americans in the last century? They were savages. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. I mean, we had to have a mythology like that in order to do what we did. And then we've talked about the other side of the coin, African Americans, and the kind of mythology that, if, for example, your Constitution says that an African is only 3/5 human, what does that suggest? Well, if you have a political ideology couched in your Constitution that says all men are created equal, and yet some men and women in your society not only are not dealt with equally, but you don't intend to give them access, then you got to have a way to confirm and to reinforce and excuse that. And so what better way than to declare that Africans are only 3/5 human, and therefore they don't quite fit in terms of the all men are created equal. Now, that's kind of the dynamics of the way the mythology of racial identity and racial superiority has worked in the history of our nation and has echoed around in the history of Canada And it's also been present in the history of all of the American nations. But each, like the kaleidoscope, has its own peculiar organization of the colors and the patterns and the shadings. But in broad brushstrokes, that kind of a feel, a whiff, of the mythology of race and the history of our people in the way that it's affected our relationships with one another and the ways in which we think and feel about one another. And I'm sure you can dramatize that for yourself. But now we want to do a little exercise that'll help us kind of get inside of the dynamics of mythology and think about how that is pulled through the screen of race in our experience.
Okay, any questions, comments, real quick?
Yes.
In the Caribbean, that genetic mixing was taking place for a couple hundred years. How come that didn't affect us more up in, you know, North America?
Well, there are politically and economically, there were some different things going on in the Caribbean. And part of it had to do with the fact that slavery under the Spanish and the French was a little bit different reality, and the Portuguese was a little bit different reality than it was under the English Protestants. And we noticed when we lived in Jamaica, and particularly when we were talking to a couple of Jamaican scholars who had done research on the songs and so on out of the slave period, they were pointing out that the old traditional songs from Jamaica tend to be much more full of life and vitality than many of the spirituals and gospels from North America, that there's not the deep sense of suffering and tragedy. And they were commenting that that probably is a reflection of the difference in the experience of Africans in the Caribbean as opposed to North America, which is not to say that slavery was easy in the Caribbean or that post-slavery was, but it was a little different reality, certainly.
Well, the French took a very different approach to race, though.
Yeah.
As a European nation than the Germans did.
Yes.
It's kind of strange.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And the Portuguese, an even different mm-hmm. approach. And we notice both in the Portuguese and the Spanish, much more mixing with the native population that they would own up to. The English did a lot of mixing also, of course. The slave masters did. But, you know, the owning up to that was a little different.
Okay. By a show of hands, how many of you in here think that all, basically, black people are lazy? Raise your hand. Come on. All right, how many of you in here think that basically Indians are just alcoholic? Raise your hand. We've got a few people coming up. Any others? What about Hispanic people? What do you think about Hispanic people? What's some of the things you think about?
First impression is
dishonest. Dishonest.
Have amazing love for children.
What?
They seem to have an amazing love for children.
Amazing love for children. Okay. What is? Go ahead.
My grandmother says they're dirty.
They're dirty.
They're dirty.
Basically,
dirty
Hispanic
mess.
People are dirty.
Okay. Macho culture. Macho, machismo.
Machismo. Okay. What are some words or phrases or sayings that you associate with black people? Anybody know of any?
Athletes.
Rhythm.
What kind of food they eat, basically?
Soul food.
What's soul food? Give us some speakers.
Collard greens, grits.
Collard greens, grits, watermelon.
Fried
what?
Fried chicken.
They love to sing gospel songs. What about Native American people? What kind of things do you associate with Native American people?
Fishing.
Beadwork. Yes. From Minnesota. What?
Sweat lodge.
Reservations. Okay. What
being
about?
Poor.
What?
Poor.
Okay. What are some basic ways that you really think you find out about this group of people? Like, what kind of jokes do you hear? Anybody know of any jokes about any of these groups of people?
I don't think that starts and stops with colored people. That carries on through the regional regions and Denmark.
Yeah. But what are some jokes you know about Hispanic people? Anybody?
if you're going to hear jokes, I think they're always on the negative side.
Okay, their ethnic jokes are usually negative.
They're always negative.
They're always negative.
Good.
You've never heard a good name. Okay.
They're not making fun of the person. Reading.
You know of any?
I know blonde jokes. I'm sorry, I know a lot of
blonde jokes. Well, it gets close. All right. Anybody else know any ethnic jokes that you dare to share? Well, what we have been doing in these last few minutes is to show you how stories get told about people, what symbols and icons are associated with people. What was somebody saying about the Hispanic people? They're just basically dirty, they care about kids, and then the foods and all that. And then some rituals, like the jokes. And that we can pretty much come up with fairly easy, can't we? Well, this evening, you're going to get a chance to work as a group, four groups, and I've mentioned those four, where you and your group will write down some stories, some symbols, and some rituals about blacks, Indians, Asians, and Hispanics. I'm going to divide you up, all the people in the balcony. Let's see. Well, I guess you can just relate to the groupings that we'll do here. So I'll start over this side.
There's 14 in the balcony.
14?
Yeah.
So that means we got four groups.
They could do
What's
their
the
own.
Division? They could. Oh, they could even do their own. That's true.
Yeah.
So we'll make three groups down here and the fourth group up here. All right. I have a few sheets that we can share around, and then afterwards we're going to talk about it like we did before in our other exercises. Okay. Black group.
Our stories are welfare on the dole, unwed teen mothers, the music, athletic, lazy, poor, barefoot, and lots of kids, lower IQ, they all look alike, they're angry, undisciplined, law-breaking criminals, inferior, subsidized, and get jobs through quotas, they're promiscuous, want white women, and subservient. Symbols, watermelon, rap music, fancy cars, hairdos, fancy clothes, kerchiefs, afros, Aunt Jemima, Little Black Sambo, happy and singing, tenements, breakdancing, language, red caps, train porters, shoe shiners, and the hitching posts that you'd see in white neighborhoods out on the front by the sidewalk.
Okay.
And the rituals, the old saying, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a nigger by the toe. The saying, last one in's a nigger baby. Nut, a type of nut that used to be called nigger toes, or that has been called nigger toes. Sports events and athletes, that we all go to sports events to see African-American athletes. Prostitution. Language, as in Amos and Andy, the old radio show, ethnic jokes, and images from TV and radio.
Okay. The Indian group. Well, who?
Same time?
No, no. Whoever's going to record. You get two groups. That's okay. Whoever wants to start.
We had with naturalists or people who are interested in nature, savages, cultural identity, lazy, alcoholism. Disregard the white amenities as far as the story aspect. Anything else?
Under story, scalping, raiding, irresponsible, lazy men, gambling, uneducated, respect for elders, savages, cowboys and Indians, Indian schools, good hunters, weaving, craftsmen, and farming.
Go to the next column. Symbols.
Symbols. Tomahawk, silver, turquoise, weaving, teepee, wigwam, papoose, buffalo, bow and arrow, loincloth, totem poles, horses, and drums.
You have anything to add?
Feathers.
Okay. Rituals.
Yeah, we have scalps and teepees.
Okay.
Yeah. Rituals, powwows, sweat lodges, medicine men, hunting, the Mother Earth, and care for the earth.
The others? And the rituals?
Yes, we need the symbols.
Then you had rituals. Did you? Okay. Asians.
We had two groups.
Okay.
Two groups.
We had two groups.
Okay, whoever's going to go first.
Okay. Okay, story. Good at math, industrious, self-sufficient, short, sneaky and clever, humble, polite, intelligent, serious and sacred, slanted eyes and speak fun.
Go ahead on your story.
We put eating dogs and cats and
under story?
Under, yeah, as part of the story.
Okay.
Life means little to them. Labor, cooking, laundry, prostitution, exotic sexuality stuff. What's that read? A female infanticide? Infanticide? Is that what it's called? And foot binding and what was the other one? Regimented.
Symbols.
Rice, raw fish, strange food, martial arts, eat on the floor, opium, and Chinese wonder.
You have anything to add on yours?
Shopkeepers. No, that's what it is.
Ritual?
Geisha is
going to. Geisha?
Rituals. Charlie Chan movies, Chinese restaurants, the words chink, groups, jap, slant high, and internment camps in
Florida. You have things to add on the ritual?
Martial arts, suicide, and chopsticks.
Mm-hmm. Anyone, what caught your attention in any of those lists that you heard about these different ethnic groups? What caught your attention?
You mean the negative.
The negative. Mm-hmm.
Degrading.
Dehumanizing.
Suspicious, dehumanizing.
Something to fear.
Something to fear. And what do we do when we have something to fear? Stay away from it or fix it so it doesn't get near us. Mm-hmm. One of the two.
Okay.
What else caught your attention?
Things that you remember thinking at home when you were a little child. Or hearing, like I remember hearing stories about black children.
Anybody have any physical? Go ahead.
I just, as a European American, how I've heard all these things. I mean, none of this is strange to me. And it's in part of our culture to have these beliefs.
Oh, okay.
All of this that's been mentioned are what separates or keeps those groups apart from the European white Americans. It's none of it emphasizes anything that would be the same.
Makes me curious what they're saying about us. It's European. Stories
about us. The sexuality theme ran through everything. Yeah. You know, the tainted sexuality thing kind of ran through all of this.
Okay. And you were?
I picked up a book in the library over here, the new one by Studs Terkel. It's called Race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the theme of that, I didn't get too much into it, but the theme seems to be that Americans have an obsession with race. Okay. No matter what your race, it's an obsession that we make these distinctions and avoid each other, and whether for all the reasons are, I didn't get into too much, but this idea
of
obsession.
Most of the time, it's done off amongst the white, it's good nature type of things.
But between
color, it tends to be a little bit more antagonistic and degrading.
So between other white people hearing stories is the good nature part.
I might tell a Polish joke, or somebody tell me a Polish joke, but they're really kind of telling it in good fun. They're not putting the Polish down quite as much as the joke might imply.
But how much of that plays into?
Sometimes in the other way, that's not true.
Oh, what was your physical or emotional response as you heard these? Because I heard a little bit of rumbling around the room.
Yeah, very uncomfortable.
Made you uncomfortable?
When I hear things like chink or nigger or something, it's like I got hit in the stomach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just felt horrible reading this. I wanted to cry when I finished. Like I was embarrassed that I said those words. I am embarrassed I said those words.
Well, that has something to do with our identity, too, how we feel that we want to feel aware and feel the pain of oppressed people. I think, you know, this might be a unique group, too.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I had two feelings. One,
makes me feel a little ashamed of embarrassed because I have a black son and a Japanese mother-in-law, Japanese American mother-in-law. Those were the two groups that hit me the hardest. The Native American one and the Hispanic one didn't bother me as much because I'm not personally involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other thing is there are many times in my life that I have not been thankful for the parents I have who are very white, very middle class. My mom's from England, but very Scandinavian on the other side. It was never okay when I was a kid to downgrade somebody for their nationality or their race. And I think that wasn't true maybe for a lot of Americans. Mm-hmm. And I should say something to her maybe about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never even think nigger. You know, and that was in the 50s when I think that was very common.
What but at the same time, all my friends could. I mean, even I couldn't say at my house, it was. I just think it's so pervasive.
It,
I just
want
to make that point. It's just.
It was.
Even,
say that. Say
even if it wasn't said in my house, everybody else I knew used the words.
Okay.
And so.
Schoolyard, not sure.
Is there
yeah. Like, would you, any of you, pick any person from the groups that you worked on as a leader from what you heard tonight?
What do you mean?
Would any of you pick someone from the ethnic group you just worked on tonight as a leader, from what you described?
No,
absolutely not.
We know you want to hire them.
You don't want to hire them?
Well, we know what we're saying is untrue. We're saying this just because we've heard it. That doesn't mean that we believe it.
No, I mean, that's not.
But how much of that plays into who we look for in terms of leadership and who we're willing to work with?
You know, we may say we don't believe it. And we may believe
that we don't believe it.
And yet at the same time in Minnesota, African American children die more than 3 times the rate of white children in the first year of life. Why is that?
Yeah.